Welcome to this week's edition of the Video News InScreen Media Podcast. This is Will Richmond from Video News, and Colin Dixon is with me back in the office this week. Colin, right? You were with us. We recorded together last week, but we're back in our separate remote routine again.
We are indeed. And so I'm back in California. I really did enjoy recording together, Will. We should try and do that more. That was really good. And I have to say, I loved the Video Advertising Summit. Had a great time. My mobile panel was great. I got to write up that panel, and I'm really looking forward to seeing you post some of the videos when they're available.
Absolutely. Thanks for that feedback. And I've gotten a lot of other good feedback on the day, a lot of work. So I've been decompressing a little bit since then. We are editing my editing team is working on the videos, and we hope to start posting the first ones early next week. And we'll certainly be writing those up on Video News as well. We'll share them with you. So all good on that front, but life carries on here. And we have a couple of topics for today's podcast. The first one is, you had heard some remarks from the head of CuriosityStream, John Hendricks, who of course is also the founder of Discovery Channel, and we want to talk about his view of the market opportunity for streaming video services. And then we're going to switch over and talk about YouTube's latest escapades in trying to play whack-a-mole with content that should not be posted on its platform. So go for it.
Yeah. So I got very interested in something John Hendricks said in a podcast called Thinking Out Loud by CTAM. He did an interview with CTAM, and that's available. That podcast is available on CTAM's website, and I highly recommend it. Very, very interesting discussion. John Hendricks, he actually talks about how he got the idea for founding Discovery Channel and how Discovery Channel grew. And he sees the same opportunity today, Will, with online, which is why he sort of jumped into doing something a little bit similar with CuriosityStream. There's a lot of parallels between CuriosityStream and Discovery. He really talked about what he sees as the opportunity. And there was one thing that really jumped out at me during that podcast, and I want to quote what he said because I thought it was very interesting. It really speaks to something that I think we don't think about enough. So what he said was, there are some 4 growing to 5 billion users of the internet, which is a stunning number. Today it's about 1 to 1.5 billion which can stream video, but that's going to grow. There will be 2 to 3 billion. So if you look at a service like Netflix, it's penetrated at 13% of the addressable market with about 150 million subscribers. So even if they just stay at that level, there'll be over 400 or 500 million households when that addressable market is at 3 billion. So what I loved about this was it really spoke to the scale that online delivery allows a service provider if they can fully grasp the international opportunity as well as the US opportunity. And that's not an easy thing to do. And it's certainly something that CuriosityStream has set out to do. And one of the things I did was I went back and I wanted to fact check some of the numbers that John threw out. And I don't want to bore our listeners with the details. If they want to get the details of my fact checking of those numbers, they can certainly come to my site. The bottom line of my fact checking was, you know, whether it's 400 or 500 million for Netflix or 200 or 300 million for Netflix at a 13% penetration, it's a big number. It's something like that. And that's the opportunity he sees there for CuriosityStream, Will. And the interesting thing is he talked about the economics of CuriosityStream, which was, to me, was absolutely fascinating. So with that scale in mind, he went on to say, if you got 50 cents from 500 million global households, which is what some of the big services like Discovery Channel have achieved, that's a huge revenue stream. That's $3 billion, which can be matched by advertising. So what he's saying is he can probably get to $6 billion. If CuriosityStream over time can get 80 cents to a dollar, That's more than enough for us to build a huge business, and it's very economical for the consumer. And you know, what this says to me is that there is tremendous scale that we can get, and that charging a very nominal amount for your service, at scale, you can still build a very interesting business. And what CuriosityStream has done is, I think, one of the most aggressive approaches to the market that any SVOD provider has done. They lowered the charge for their service from, I think it was $6.99, it's now $2.99 a month. Or you can just pay $19.99, $20 and get a whole year's worth of service. Now, for me, that's a no-brainer. I love Factual. I love the type of content that they have there. And really, if they can charge that and they can get to 500 million subscribers, that's a $10 billion business. That's $10 billion per year in subscription revenue alone. That's a very, very big number. Of course, for Netflix, this is an even bigger number. That's a $72 billion business, which is absolutely massive. But it really does speak to the fact that you've got great scale. And the thing I love about what John Hendricks was saying was that he wanted to make sure it was a good deal for consumers as well, which is why he's lowered that price and he's really looking for scale to sort of make things up. He calls this pricing for the planet. And I've got to tell you, at $2.99 a month, that plays well in a lot of regions of the world where, say, Netflix at $10 or $12 doesn't. So Netflix or $10 or $12 in Asia, it really doesn't work in many, many places. But $2.99 or close to it still does. So I thought that was a fascinating discussion from John Hendricks. As I say, I think people should definitely check that out on CTAM. But it really does speak to the scale that we're looking at. And this is part of the reason why I think Netflix is valued so highly, because that's the opportunity that investors are looking at and thinking, you know, if they can get to that level, it's a massive business. It's, you know, $70 billion business, which is absolutely huge.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to listen to the podcast that you're referring to, so I'm going a little bit by how you're recapping things. And I think it is interesting, certainly, to look, as John Hendricks is doing, from a sort of a top-down mentality that the X number of people are going to be online, X number of people, Y number of people are going to be able to stream video. If you can just get a small percentage of them and also even charge 50 cents or something like that, 80 cents, a dollar, keep that per month, that can add up to a huge revenue stream. I guess one question I would have, or maybe one quibble with looking at it from such a purely sort of top-down point of view, is that you and I both know that when he talks about 50 cents from 500 million subscribers, like he's referring to Discovery Channel has done, there are a whole lot of those 500 million subscribers that never tune into Discovery Channel even one single time per month, and that they're in effect kind of like benefiting from the free rider syndrome that is so rampant in the pay TV industry, where we know that the average viewer only watches maybe a dozen, 15, 20 at the most channels per month, and yet they're paying for all the others as well. And that's been a huge boon to certainly the sports-oriented network. So that 50 cents from 500 million is a really nice part of the pay TV paradigm, but CuriosityStream and all these other OTT services are direct-to-consumer, and they need to establish a value proposition to X number of households that are willing to subscribe and willing to continue subscribing and not churn out. And that number is obviously going to be way, way smaller than 500 million. So it seems to me that, like, the top down, hey, here's the addressable market. Yes, that's a very good starting point, but replicating the monthly economics that the cable networks or broadcast networks have seen by being a part of the bundled pay TV offering, to me that starts to seem like a different business model's rules being applied and that are not going to come anywhere close to fruition.
So there's certainly something to be said for what you're saying. However, there's a couple of other things that I think make me think that they can approach that, Will. Maybe they can't get all the way there. But here's the thing. Discovery Channel, I understand you're absolutely right about Discovery Channel's model. It's pretty different. There's not an explicit subscription to Discovery. You get it as part of your pay TV subscription. But here's the thing, when people ask consumers which channels they value the most, Discovery is consistently in the top 10. Viewership does not follow that top 10 placing. So if you look at the average viewership of that channel, it's not in the top 10. But people value it very highly. So, and this actually links to something. Somebody, I forget who it was at the conference last week, Will, said that, I think they said 18% of people have a subscription and they never really use it.
Yep.
But they still value it. So I think at $2.99 a month, CuriosityStream is kind of in that territory. It's like a magazine subscription. It's cheaper than a magazine subscription, and you would keep it around because you think you might want to watch, not because you are watching a lot. Now, I happen to think there's a lot of great content on there, which will get a lot of people to watch. So there's that aspect. The other thing is that one of the things that CuriosityStream has done is, I think John Hendricks said 40% of their stuff is original. They have been very, very careful to ensure that they have worldwide rights to the content that they are creating themselves. And he also said within 2 years, 60% of the content on CuriosityStream will be originals that they created with worldwide rights. So they have no restriction in being able to offer this everywhere. And he was very careful to also say that they have these rights and can deliver in markets like China, which, of course, Netflix has shied away from, which could be one of the reasons why Netflix can't actually get to that 500 million projected, because it's not in that big market and it's also not very successful in India at the moment. So I would say there's that aspect as well, that they've got worldwide rights and they can actually appear anywhere they want. They can take that content anywhere they want. And the third thing is that their distribution strategy is really advanced. I talked to Adeline Cassin, who's the head of marketing for CuriosityStream, and she talks about the fact that they take CuriosityStream through every channel that a potential viewer could want to watch it through. So, for example, they're on Amazon channels. They're even available through Verve, from Elation, through their platform. So they're really taking CuriosityStream to every platform that they think they can get subscribers through. They can reach their customers through. I think it's even available on X1 from Comcast. So yes, I hear you. It is a very different model. But when you're priced so low, when you're priced at $2.99, and he actually said they've tested lower than that, they can go lower than that. When you're at that level, then maybe they can capitalize on this quote membership theory, this idea that having it around and having access to it is worth the price, even if you don't use it. So I don't know. That's what I think. He's approached the way he's approaching it.
Yeah, I think the $2.99 price is a smart level in terms of like what you're describing. It's sort of flying below people's radar a little bit. It's not like they're paying 20 or 50 or 100 per month, and it's sort of a glaring charge that they're thinking about every month and wanting to address. At $3 a month, it sort of flies below the attention radar, if you will. But at the same time, they have to obviously be able to generate enough revenue and profitability to fund a slate of high quality programming that is going to be appealing. So I think it's a good test case. I like the idea that the company is backed by someone who knows the rules of the road in the subscription TV business. But I do think, and I want to listen to that podcast to see if he addresses this point, I do think there is a divergence, as we're talking about, in terms of being part of a bundle and the sort of leverage, tailwind, whatever you want to call it, that gives you, versus having to run a DTC business and go out and market to viewers directly and get them to not just sign up, but to stay in with you. That's the challenge, I think, that all these direct-to-consumer streaming services have, regardless of what they're pricing at, whether they're Disney Plus or Apple TV Plus or obviously Netflix, Hulu, et cetera, on down to the niche services like CuriosityStream. They all are facing the same fundamental challenges of being able to market effectively, add to their subscription base, and then retain their subscribers.
Yeah. And he does address that point, Will, not head on, but sort of indirectly. There's one other aspect that I really loved in his discussion, and that was the advertising. And they don't take advertising, but they do take sponsorship. And he talked about a different approach to advertising and giving brands access to the viewer base in a different way, and they're really onto something here. They're doing stuff with Toyota, for example. They have the Toyota Theater, and Toyota sponsors the creation of content in that theater, and it's really great content. I really like the way he thinks about bringing brands in for sponsorship, and I think that will take them a long way and help fund creation of some of the content. In fact, they're just about to release a new series called Speed, which sounds like very, very high quality, right up my street, the sort of thing I love to watch, and I will certainly be tuning into that. So, and I think that was done in partnership with one of the brand sponsors that they're working with. So, you know, it's a pretty interesting model, and I think I'm very optimistic that it's going to do extremely well.
Yeah, well, it's going to be fun to watch, that's for sure.
You bet.
And so why don't we switch gears a little bit and talk about the other topic that we mentioned at the top here, which is YouTube's ongoing game of whack-a-mole. It's like a week or two cannot go by without some new scandal or mini scandal popping up about YouTube and them trying to tamp it down these days, right?
Yeah, it's a real challenge. So what happened this week? What did they do this week?
Well, this week they announced that a new policy, which is going to ban, quote, videos alleging that a group is superior in order to justify discrimination, segregation, or exclusion. It's basically aimed at those channels related to, well, doing any kind of hate speech or conspiracy advancement or anything that might be considered predatory related to kids. So there was another story that surfaced about how certain videos, user-generated videos of kids that had been uploaded, got a massive number of views because they had been manipulated or highlighted in one way or another to kind of sexualize them or make them more provocative than certainly they were intended to be. And again, it's another sort of example of how bad actors are able to manipulate content that's on the YouTube platform. And YouTube, like the other platforms, it's not right to single them out, certainly, because Facebook has had this issue, as have other platforms. But this recurring theme that the platforms themselves, the companies running these platforms, do not yet seem to have a full control over how their platforms are being used and what content is being displayed, and that leads to these periodic and at this point somewhat inevitable scandals or mini scandals, which then require them to make these announcements and also continue to invest in trying to improve the safety of their platform. So we know Facebook has been through all kinds of this over the past couple of years, going all the way back to the election, certainly going right up through the recent shooting, tragic shooting in Christchurch in New Zealand. And we kind of get these continuing examples, where regardless of what investment they're making, they can't quite seem to keep up. And it's pretty unnerving, don't you think?
I sure do. And, you know, this is a great example, Will, of the openness of the YouTube platform is its strength, but it's also its biggest fault. And that's the problem that they have here, right? They're trying to backfill now to remove unsavory content and make it, I guess, more like a TV environment where it's much safer. But the problem is that's not the nature of the platform. And the attempts that they've made so far, every time they try something, people find ways to get around it. So, you know, I give a great example, the pedophiles. They were successful, I think, in repressing that type of content. But then these guys popped up on kid-oriented channels making posts against the content with equally unsavory approaches. And YouTube has done a lot. That look, they've not been standing still. They've manipulated their algorithms to try and do a better job at policing what content is uploaded. They have hired 20,000 people to review content to try and remove unsavory content. But whatever they do, people always seem to find a way to get around it. And that, I mean, that's the nature of their platform. And I honestly, I don't know how successful they'll be in pulling down the hate speech. The problem with making absolute rules is that you end up inadvertently removing stuff that you probably should allow for real discussions to occur in the community. And that's an unfortunate offshoot of making an absolute rule. And I don't know how they get around this, Will, that without destroying what made YouTube great and what continues to make it so engaging for people around the world. I just don't know how they do it.
Yeah, I agree with that. I've seen commentary from some people who have said, you know, more radical approaches, like YouTube says 500 hours of content are uploaded every minute, that content should not be activated until it's been fully scanned. And that if YouTube doesn't have the capacity to scan everything before it gets publicly activated, then they should, you know, kind of stand down from what they're doing. And if they can't keep up, they can't keep up. But as you point out, then the question is, even if they could scan everything before it was activated, what things might still slip through? And so that's not even a perfect solution.
No. And I can't come up with one. I think they can only do what they are doing, and that is to continually, you know, play the whack-a-mole game. As they see things pop up, stamp it down. And that's the only thing that they can do, I think, at this point.
Well, maybe the only thing that they can do, but it certainly seems like the groundswell of momentum for some kind of regulation around not just YouTube, but the other platforms as well, is growing in Washington. So we'll have to see whether what they do is enough, or what they're lobbying allows them to do is enough, or whether the government finally decides that they need to intervene, which could obviously have some unintended consequences.
Yeah, you bet. And I don't know, this is stumbling into an area that is going to create some ferocious debates, because we're talking about the nature of free speech here. And
yeah,
boy, that's an area that probably is out of scope for our humble podcast.
Right. And also out of scope, I think, for the time that we have remaining here. And I think we do need to wrap up on that note, although an inconclusive note.
Indeed. So always fun talking with you, Will.
Likewise, Colin. And thanks, everyone, for listening in on this week's edition of the Video News Endscreen Media Podcast. And we'll see you all again next week.